with sin suggests that all of us are born into the world with sinful natures. 6 out of 7 days, I hate this notion. We are born pure, pure as the baby's butt. As we begin to see, listen, and observe, it is then that we develop the capacity for both good and for evil. The evil, or the good that we do, is an amalgamation of both nature and nurture, not a triumph of nature over nurture. For some, the struggle is obviously harder than it is for others, and to choose good in the face of overwhelming temptation or simple want and need is practically more difficult. It seems that so much of this boils down to the chance of a miracle found in the grand petri dish of life, that place where our DNA mixes in with the lottery of where and to whom you were born. We are either born victims to or benefactors of the environment we are brought into, and there's not much that we can do or say about it at our beginning, but only when we dare to grow up. Simply stated, it's not fair. For none of us deserve, and yet a great many of us inherit large homes, private educations, and paid tuitions, summer camps, piano lessons, and well, everything that one could dream of. While others of equal merit at conception inherit nothing but a sack of potatoes, poor education, a lack of parental presence, an environment riddled with crime and only the most fleeting dreams to even guess at what a summer camp might look like. And yet, rather unjustly, it is up to each of us to make the most of that which we have been given, regardless if we are those found swimming upstream against the current, or those of us who are blissfully floating along downstream in a golden tube. Each of us are presented with options and circumstances that lead to doors that we can either choose to open or to close. Do we give in to the temptations of sin and darkness? Do we give in to the thralls of despair? Or do we attempt to overcome them with righteousness and light, seeking after life, even where there's only mostly death? It is up to us to make these choices. And it is these choices that we make, especially the ones in our younger, more youthful, more vulnerable, and formative years of our lives, in those ages of development, that are crucial in either altering or sustaining who we are meant to be and who we are to become. Out of all the Gospels, it is Luke's Gospel which presents us with the richest details of Jesus' youth. And yet, what Luke actually gives us is hardly anything at all. The majority of the formative years of Jesus' life are either omitted or simply unknown to Luke. All we get is the proclamation by Mary, that's of the angel to Mary, his miraculous birth, and then the boy at age 12 left behind in the temple. The next thing we know, he's age 30. In the wilderness, beginning his private ministry, they or so later, he's walking home on the road. Boy bumps into him a little too hard. Jesus curses him, and he drops dead. The neighborhood comes to Joseph the father and says, "What is wrong with your son? Can you do something, please?" Literally, in quotes, it is said, "He is killing all of our children." Joseph tries to corral Jesus, and Jesus laughs at his father, saying, "You are not my father. My father is from above." Which is interesting, because I imagine his father from above probably would ordain killing of other children. It's a heretical gospel. Now, later in the gospel, this is where it gets to the point. As he's getting older and approaching 12, he finally begins to learn and to grow in wisdom and in strength and maturity. He gets to put the puzzle pieces together and figures out who he is. He chooses what he wants to do with his abilities and his power. He's then said to hear a woman who is lamenting over the loss of her son. He goes running out to her house. He resurrects her son. He sees a man whose foot had been chopped off in an axe accident. He heals this man's foot. His brother James is bitten by a viper. He heals James' wounds. His mother asks for water to bring him to the house. He goes gets that water. He resurrects a man who has fallen down dead at a construction site. He does all these things, and ultimately, he's working in the field with his father. He's working with a single grain. He sees some poor, and he says, "I'm going to multiply this into a harvest so to feed the poor." The infancy gospel ends with him at 12 in the temple, the same story that we get in Luke, where he is teaching the elders. Jesus has now grown up and become who he was always meant to be. The gospel's point, even if correctly labeled heretical by later authorities, is not all that different from those obscure verses that we get in Luke 2. That suggests even Jesus, the prophesied Son of God, had to learn and grow in wisdom so to recognize, elect, and become who he was always meant to be, the realized Son of God. Jesus had to learn to rise above his circumstances. Remember, he was born to the poor and disenfranchised artisan class. And he had to choose to no longer succumb to oppression or hostility, but instead to choose right over wrong, to choose light over dark, to choose righteousness over personal gain, to choose wonder over terror. All spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his mouth. "Is not this Joseph's son?" Biblical scholar Joel Green writes, "In spite of the prophecies regarding Jesus, it remained for Jesus to fully embrace his status and mission as Son of God. So when he willfully goes into the wilderness at age 30 and subsequently begins his public ministry and his private ministries, Jesus has in effect chosen to accept his calling, to claim it, and to fulfill it. And when he does choose it, he is changed. He is no longer the mere carpenter. He is now fully the Messiah." He begins his ministry. In the very first lesson of his ministry, he gives us our text. He teaches the elders. There's a severe famine in all the land. Yet Elijah was sent to none of them, except to a widow at Zarephath in Sidon. There are also many lepers around in that time, and Elijah was only sent to Naaman the Syrian. Understand that both the widow at Zarephath and Naaman the Syrian were outsiders. They were non-Jews. They were considered unclean. One was even a leper. And yet, out of the wealth of the entire Old Testament text, Jesus evokes these two names at the beginning of his ministry. His point, then, is simple, and it is clear. God has anointed me, and I am now ready to choose this appointed time to bring good news to the poor, to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. For today I heavy today, then hear the good news. Are you in pain? Is a loved one you know hurting? Are you feeling alone, friendless, isolated, on the outside looking in? Then here is the good news. For just as Elijah and Elijah were sent to the outsiders in Sidon and Syria, so too is Jesus elected to come to you. He brings with himself living waters and a refreshing spirit, renewing you continuously in the fonts of forgiveness, mercy, and grace. Indeed, the Spirit is willing, even if the flesh is weak. The events and choices of our past are remembered no more. For while, yes, Nicodemus, we can be born again. For like the persecutor Saul became the apostle Paul, so too has Jesus Christ, with the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, made us so that we are able to start over. So hear the good news. The doors on the street have been opened. All the daughters of the song have been raised high. The grasshopper leaps along and hope is won. For the pitcher is pouring at the fountain. The wheel is turning at the cistern. The silver cord has been mended and the golden bowl has been put back together. For we have been made new, made original, pure with a clean slate. For today and tomorrow, light reigns over darkness. For today and tomorrow, life triumphs over death and conquers despair. As great as this news is, Luke's gospel, Luke's good news, it does not end at chapter 24. For it marches onward into the book of Acts, Luke is said to have authored both. You see, for Luke, the story of Christ was incomplete if it ended at his death, his resurrection, and his ascension. The story was only alive and breathing if it continued onward through his disciples and their choice to follow him. And so if we, too, choose to be called as followers, to truly fulfill that designation in 2016, shouldn't then we also choose to live a life following in his footsteps, choosing to imitate his works and his ways rather than our own wants and our own wishes? In closing, I'd like to offer you a short vignette of what that might actually look like rather than just mere words spoken in a sermon. 2 weeks ago, our youth group went to West Kensington Ministry to begin a partnership. We were there for the weekend.